Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got Larry Downs, Kevin Thompson, and me. We're going to talk about soybeans and their patentability and replicability. On the copyright front, we'll look at 3D printing and making your own glass if you're an entrepreneur in China. Lots to talk about privacy as well, with Nicole Wong helping out the White House now, and Nordstrom not tracking you with your smartphone. Are we going to get rid of the switched telephone networks? We hope so, but not very soon. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 211, recorded May 17, 2013. Blame it on the beans. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile by Citrix. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWiL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you've joined us for This Week in Law, where we discuss all the most cutting-edge issues at the intersection of technology and law. And we've got a wonderful panel of folks joining me today to do that. Both return timers to the show, Larry Downs. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Denise. Sorry to be joining you only in a voice today.
That's all right. We were speculating before the show that perhaps the FCC is stomping all over your communications abilities in light of some of the things you've been writing lately. And we'll get to that in a bit. But it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, regardless of how you can join us.
Thanks. Your insights, it's nice to be here.
Your insights are always so valuable. So we're thrilled you're here. Also joining us, one of our favorite panelists, the cyber lawyer, Kevin Thompson. Hello, Kevin.
Well, hi, Denise. Thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it.
It's wonderful to have you back on. Evan Brown, folks, for those of you who are looking around and not seeing my usual co-host, is busy today, and we miss him, and he will be back next week. So we will soldier on without Evan. We've got tons of great stuff to talk about this week, lots of stuff on the privacy front. So let's get to that first. Well, Larry, you're in Berkeley today, as I understand it, and that's also where our new internet privacy advisor to the White House is hanging out. That's Nicole Wong, and she is someone who's just a wonderful person for the White House to tap, and I'm pretty excited about her having an influential role in advising the White House about internet and privacy issues. She worked for Google for quite a long time and Twitter for a couple of years, and now she's going to be helping the White House understand crucial issues of privacy related to the internet. So this is a great thing as far as I'm concerned. Are you familiar with Nicole, Larry?
I am. I know Nicole very well, and I agree with you. This is a great development. It's unfortunately the story broke in a kind of unfortunate way, and I have to blame a little bit my good friend and colleague Declan McCullough at CNET. He originally reported that she was being hired to be a privacy czar for the White House, which isn't correct, and it also led people to the impression that what she was being hired to do was to sort of protect the privacy of people working in the White House, so sort of their chief privacy officer. That's not it at all. She's there. I mean, obviously, there's tremendous amounts of activity going on, both legislative proposals for privacy at the state and federal level, and then of course the Federal Trade Commission continues to use its authority. I would argue more than it should, but it's using its authority to try and police privacy practices on the internet. My understanding is that what Nicole is there to do is very sensibly to help the White House, help the administration keep track of all these developments and to develop, what the White House's policy should be on various pieces of legislation or various enforcement actions, which makes tremendous sense.
Yeah, it makes tons of sense to me, too. Kevin, have you followed Nicole's career as well?
Yes, I have. I just was very happy to see that she got appointed. She's certainly no stranger to making big, important decisions. You know, her career at Google and some of the things that she's done, but in particular, you know, her role with, you know, the censorship in Turkey. I think, you know, she certainly showed that, you know, she can make a tough call, you know, when things are there and balance interests. And I think she's certainly a good catch for the White House.
Right. They nicknamed her the decider over that decision that she made regarding Turkey, which had to do with videos related to Ataturk that the government was upset about. And the government in Turkey was never happy with what Google did. But, you know, when you've got to make decisions like this, you're not going to make everybody happy. And I believe what she did was block the videos only in Turkey.
I believe that's correct.
So there was, you know, some degree of censorship involved, but also some degree of sensitivity to, you know, something that's offensive in a particular country and necessary in order for Google to maintain its operations in that country. Those kinds of hard decisions they face all the time. I also think that this is an interesting and sort of complementary development. There's an article in Computing Now by a couple of, I believe they're professors, if not administrators, at Carnegie Mellon University, discussing at length the shortage of privacy engineers in the U.S. and the fact that universities aren't addressing the fact that there's this shortage, and that they are going to, at Carnegie Mellon at any rate, start offering courses that enable people to graduate from there with a good background in privacy law, policy, and design, and go to work for companies and help them sort through those issues. This came through on the Project VRM mailing list with the note that it's so nice to see somebody even paying attention to the fact that privacy engineering is important and that we need more people paying attention to this. So, Larry, did you look at this at all?
Yes, I looked at it. You know, I'm something of a privacy skeptic, Denise, as you know, and I don't have any objection to this idea of what is referred to more by policymakers, frankly, than by engineers, however, as privacy by design. I like the idea, frankly, that when people are developing new hardware, software, app products, that they should take into consideration, you know, what kinds of privacy considerations or what kinds of things might upset consumers, especially if it's something very new or you know, has sort of that hint of being creepy about it, and to take that in consideration in designing the product and how they launch the product and how they advertise the product. A lot of the stories I think you listed for this week have that element to them. The problem is, though, that really, you know, privacy by design is more of a slogan than an actual field of discipline. We still don't really understand, and I've said this, you know, so many times that people are bored hearing it, what do people actually mean by privacy? It's not, it's nowhere near as clear-cut as we wish it would be. And so when we get to the specifics of talking about, you know, do not track, what does that mean? What should it mean? There really is such a bad conversation going on with so little actual rational analysis behind it that I think the real problem here is not that there aren't enough engineers who understand privacy. It's more that the people who, you know, including consumers who think there's something wrong, can't really articulate what it is that's wrong, what specifically they want, and what they don't want, and how we should go about getting it. So I think, to me, that's the bigger problem than you know, the sort of a lack of expertise among engineers.
Yes, but I think you've hit on something that it's still possible to have good coursework around in a university setting, and that is how you manage people's expectations. Yeah. Such that the things that, you know, they care about as confidential and important in their private lives are addressed in a way, both contractually and architecturally, that makes sure that people don't have these terrible public relations debacles when expectations are not met.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yes, I do. And, we saw several examples of that this week. I mean, you may come, I know you're going to come to this later, but the Nordstrom story, there's been a lot about Google Glass. a year before the product is out, there are already privacy crises related to it. It's tricky. I think, I've advised companies, sort of generally and specifically for many years that, they need to get out ahead when they're introducing a new product or service that's got any kind of new personal information relative, to how it's collecting or using it. They just have to assume that people are going to overreact or misunderstand and that, whether it's rational or not, that they've got to, as you say, manage expectations well before product launch. In the case of Google Glass, we have, a year before the product's out, and already there's almost a general, Mike Masnick at TechDirt has already called this a moral panic that with, pitchforks blazing and so on. So it's getting to be a bigger problem, but as I say, to me, it's more of a management problem and a marketing problem than it is an engineering problem.
Yeah, good points. Kevin, what if you were going to college today? You think you might go into privacy expectation management and privacy by design rather than law?
That's a good question. I think, hindsight being 2020, I think I certainly would probably take more software courses and stuff. I've always, mentioned that to people when they've asked, if there's anything you'd do more of. I certainly took my fair share of computer classes when I was in school, just not enough to, to get a degree in that particular topic. So, but that's hindsight. But the one thing I think about this, though, is that, we may not know all the details and the permutations of what a course like this would do, what it would focus on. But the mere fact that, Carnegie Mellon is focusing on, privacy in their course instruction, I think it's a good thing. It's sort of like us as lawyers, if we focus on abstract legal theory for, training lawyers, we train lawyers that are good with abstract legal thinking. You sort of get what you put in there. There's a sort of a push these days, for lawyers to have more practical course instruction, such that they would be able to come out of law school and more able to actually function in the practice of law and be able to write a pleading, do more practical things. And I think focus on that it's good because then, you get what you want. You get, lawyers that did come out of law school and not, thinking all these abstract thoughts, they're more functional and more able to practice. So if they're focusing on privacy, I think that's a good thing because then, privacy itself will be more debated and be more discussed. And I think also better understood. I think, it's going to take a while before you get obviously any more of these people that are trained this way to come out of Carnegie Mellon for sure. But I think you'll certainly see, hopefully, a better understanding of privacy. So you'd have less of these cases where, as Larry pointed out, people, they know something's wrong, but they can't articulate it.
Well, I can barely articulate the acronym for their program. Somebody needs to work on that and do some designing of a better handle for it, because right now they're calling it MSIT-P, MSIT-PE, a Master's of Science in Information Technology and Privacy Engineering. A one-year program designed for computer scientists and engineers who want to pursue careers as privacy engineers or technical privacy managers. And they have a quote at the end here from Trevor Hughes, president and CEO of the International Association of Privacy Professionals, who says, "As the field of privacy grows around the globe, we are seeing a clear need for highly trained engineers who can translate the complexity of privacy into technology." So it's sort of the flip of what we see practicing technology, not law, where we need to have, a strong technical background to be able to explain to courts how the law should work. These folks are needing a strong policy background and consumer concern background, I guess, to be able to design products that make sense. So I thought that was kind of interesting. One thing that may wind up subverting some people's expectations is a biometric database of people's facial images tied to their identity that is buried in the 800 pages of immigration reform law that has been recently debated in the Senate. Over at Wired, David Kravitz writes about the fact that there's this innocuous provision of the law called Photo Tool, which amounts to a massive federal database administered by the Department of Homeland Security that contains the names, ages, social security numbers, and photographs of everyone in the country with a driver's license or other state-issued photo ID. The reason this is tied to the immigration law is that employers are supposed to look up every new hire in the database to verify that they match their photo. But what David points out in his article is this is really like a federal ID program without a card. You know, there's a picture and a database and the ability to check against it. So this isn't law yet, but it is something that is lurking in this lengthy bit of legislation. Larry, do you think this kind of thing would be problematic enough if it comes to light that it would be carved out?
Oh, probably. Yeah. There's sort of a real a moral panic, to use the phrase, particularly around anything having to do with the government in this country, but, you know, in lots of parts of Europe as well. I mean, on the one hand, you can understand why this makes a certain amount of sense. The Department of Homeland Security, you know, has to manage millions of people and you know, make sure, of course, you know, if ever, you know, a terrorist or an evil doer gets through the system, there is, of course, hell to pay, as there should be. And so it's understandable that they'd want to use whatever technology is available to help them sift through all these people coming in and out of the country who most of whom, of course, nearly all of them are people we'd like to have coming in and out of the country, but there are some that we don't. And those are the ones that, you know, always want to do these things ex post. We always want to say after the fact, well, we wish we had just taken, you know, better video surveillance of these bad people doing these bad things, or had, you know, closer surveillance on these 10 people who turned out to be criminals or evildoers. But, of course, it doesn't work that way. We never know until after the fact what information we wish we had collected. And the only way to really solve the problem is to collect a certain amount of information and have it available so that after the fact, when something goes wrong, we've got it to go back and look through to find out, oh, you know, can we find the video, you know, the bombers in Boston and all the other terrible things. And there's a real kind of conflict, and particularly in the American psyche, between, you know, wanting to keep things, you know, the government from spying, and on the other hand, insisting that the government protect us. And it's really, in many ways, it's a lose-lose proposition. So it's understandable, I think, why the government would like to, you know, have photographic database and be able to apply software to use that to, you know, be able to, without human error, go through and find stuff. On the other hand, I think, you know, once it becomes, as soon as somebody starts to refer to it as the national ID card or as, you know, any kind of, you know, Big Brother thing, that's usually the end of it in terms of Congress.
Well, I mean, it seems somewhat facile to think that something like this doesn't already exist, and maybe not in the Department of Homeland Security, but possibly the CIA or, you know, all of the NSA. This seems like, you know, maybe the Department of Homeland Security saying, hey, we need some love too. We need to know who these people are.
Technology to scan photos and identify people, it's probably right. Well, you know, what makes us think that the government, you know, can't just use Facebook to do it?
Right. Exactly. Kevin, what do you think about the mission creep point brought up in David Kravitz's article that, you know, you started out with a Social Security card all those years ago so that people could claim their retirement benefits, but now you need it to get health insurance and, you know, it comes up in so many parts of your life. Are you concerned that that kind of thing would happen here?
I think it's so certainly you know, possible. I mean, think there's, you know, once you give up certain, you know, privacy rights or other rights like that, you know, they sort of tend to be taken for granted that they're gone and things are, you know, just generally out there. They know this information will be available for the immigration to use, but you can certainly say, well, and then it's built. You could imagine, as you say, Homeland Security using the same database. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, types of, you know, potential, uses out there that could exist. So, you know, to answer your question, I think you know, yes, I think that there can be this creep of mission, as he pointed out, you know, the Social Security card, you know, it had one limited purpose when it first came out, but then got you know, used for a bunch of everything. And these days, you know, it's hard to fill out, you know, a loan or anything, you know, without, you know, supplying your Social Security number or any other sort of identifying, you know, number like that. So, you know, I think it's inevitable if, you know, this thing gets out there that, you know, it would certainly start to be used for more things.
Well, let's shift gears for a second from talking about what the government knows to what companies know about us. In California, we discussed a few weeks back, there was a piece of legislation pending. Technically, it's still pending, but it's on sort of long-term hold at this point. It was called the Right to Know Act, and it would have operated somewhat like people are used to the credit reporting agencies having the obligation to provide you with a free credit report. It would have obligated companies that gather data about you to respond to requests once a year to tell you what they have and who they're sharing it with and how it's being used. So it's sort of a step, a personalized step beyond what's stated in companies' privacy policies, where they also tell you what they're gathering and how it's going to be used and who they're sharing it with, presumably. But this would be personalized just to you. And the outcry about it was that it would be wildly expensive to respond to and burdensome. And apparently, those sorts of concerns have carried the day with Assemblymember Bonnie Lowenthal, who has placed the act on hold for now. In the legislature, she says, it's become clear that we still have our work cut out for us. So I think she's sensing that there are hurdles that might be insurmountable to getting this thing passed. So, Larry, I saw this in your Twitter stream that this had been sidelined for the time being. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised. I'm very relieved. I mean, there's so many problems with this legislation, not the least of which is the idea that we would do on a state-by-state basis different disclosure requirements for data. I mean, just even if the legislation was a model of clarity, which it was certainly not, the idea that there would be 50 different states, and maybe why not local? Like, I live in Berkeley. I'm sure the Berkeley City Council would love to have their own version of this as well. So why not, you know, millions of municipalities also implying their own particular data disclosure standards? The problem with the legislation beyond that was it was very vague, and it really doesn't understand, you know, the drafters don't understand that what people collect is not a nice little dossier that you can send to somebody. It's data elements, and maybe in some cases millions of data elements, which out of context don't tell you anything. So even if they gave you sort of the file dump of what they have on you, it would be meaningless to you. And this is, I think, a problem with, you know, I'm all for transparency and disclosure, but at a certain point it becomes, in fact, so much noise that it becomes less helpful than not. And I keep thinking every time, you know, I've refinanced my mortgage a number of times in the last 10 years. Every time I do, I get this 200-page packet of mandatory disclosures because, again, I live in California. We have lots of federal ones. We have lots of specific state ones. We have county ones and so on and so forth. And indeed, there's a lot of important information in those 200 pages somewhere, but the more disclosures you get, in fact, the harder it is to actually find the ones or the ones that have data that you actually need or could make use of. And this is why, you know, I get worried about sort of this thing, well, just tell us everything. Just tell us everything. Tell consumers everything you know about them or everything you do or everything you've got. It really becomes so much noise that even if they could make sense out of it, they would never find the valuable information.
Kevin, what do you think about Larry's point that this doesn't make sense on a regional basis and that it gets unmanageable if every municipality and state is trying to enforce something like this? Do you think that there's a role for something more on a national scale, as with the credit reporting companies?
Oh, I would certainly hope so. I think if there is going to be any of this type of of legislation. I think it really should be more at the national level. You look at, privacy and, some of these other policies, and, you've already got to craft them depending on, what, jurisdictions, companies are doing business in. Especially if a company is doing, business in the European Union, I think a lot of companies will tailor their privacy policies to be, compliant, with the most restrictive policy out there. To the extent that you have multiple jurisdictions, I think you're going to have, even more disagreements between jurisdictions as to which one is the right approach to take. And I also couldn't agree more with Larry's point is, the more disclosures you get, the more noise and the harder it is to sift through and the harder it is to find the one that's important.
So how do we address that, though? I mean, clearly people want this kind of information. The point the lawmaker in California said, Californians don't need to be persuaded that they should be able to ask a business what it knows about them and who it's sharing that information with. So how do we square the fact that we also don't like a lot of noise, Larry? And I agree, every time you refinance, it's a nightmare.
Well, I'm not convinced. Honestly, I'm not convinced that the Californians are convinced that they want to know or they need to know or they're going to actually. Every time we pass one of these things, you can get a free credit report every year. And credit reports, okay, look, that's very specific information. It's clearly defined in the Reporting Act what data elements have to be disclosed to consumers and how to interpret them. So even something like a credit report, which is very narrow, that it's important. I'm completely understanding of that. And even so, how many Californians get their credit report, read it every year, understand it, pay attention to it, and act on it? Well, I'm sure many of the people who follow your program will be out there saying, yes, I do it. I do it every year. The truth mm-hmm. is, the general population, they don't do it. And they don't have the time or the resources, and they don't care. I mean, there's a certain, it sounds good, and when you do these surveys, are you worried about your privacy? Yes. Are you giving away information without thinking about it? Yes. What's the cognitive dissonance here? Well, most of the time, what we're doing makes sense, and when company X asks us for a credit card because we're buying something, we understand that, and we give them the credit card, and everything, 90%, 99% of the time, the transaction works just fine. And nothing goes wrong. Again, it's only in that sort of whatever small percentage of the time when something doesn't go wrong, when we say, oh, we should have, been able to demand X, Y, and Z. But the truth is, there's easier ways to fix problems that are happening on a small scale than by requiring mandatory disclosure of everything to everybody when almost nobody wants it anyway.
All right. Well, we're going to have to just shelve the issue of what people do and don't want and let that play out with the legislators and see what they're lobbied to do. One kind of lobbying group that's out there that has paid attention to how to draft a good acronym is something called Net Choice. And they have published their iAwful list, which is short for Internet Advocates Watch List for Ugly Laws. Now, we should let you know that Net Choice is a coalition that includes AOL, eBay, the Electronic Retailing Association, Expedia, Facebook, Living Social, News Corp, Overstock.com, Reed Elsevier, TrueCar, VeriSign, Yahoo, and the Wine Institute. So these folks have decided that California tops the list of terrible bills that affect internet privacy. Larry, do you agree with them?
Yay, we're number one. California, see, we've come back. Yeah, I don't always agree 100% with NetChoice's viewpoints, but I'm pretty look. Their basic position is always to say, these are examples where the law really is not in sync with reality, and it's because, as we all know, and we talk about all the time, technology is changing much more quickly than the law can keep up with. And that's, you know, we could, that could be the theme of every episode of This Week in Law. Every topic you cover, in some way, it boils down to law is slow to change. That's just its nature. Our world is changing at an accelerating pace thanks to wonderful improvements in technology, many of them invented here in California, in fact. And, you know, what NetChoice does is kind of to highlight some of the biggest gaps between reality and what the law is doing. They, of course, are particularly active, particularly the last several months, on the Marketplace Fairness Act and this idea that, all Internet retailers or Internet retailers of a certain size or whatever the final definition is have to start collecting sales tax or tax in, you know, whatever jurisdictions you live in as the consumer rather than where the company actually does business. They're opposed to that for reasons that are obvious from the list of companies that you just named, Denise. But mm-hmm. I think in general they're right that you know, most of the laws they talk about, the lawmakers, you know, they really don't understand the technology. They kind of, you know, hear something, they think, oh, that's not a good idea, or I don't like that. And a lot of times they're poorly drafted. They're not really thought through. The costs and benefits are not weighed. And the ability of, say, you know, enforcement by regulators or by the departments of, you know, justice or whatever, who's going to be responsible for enforcing these laws, their capability to do so isn't taken into consideration. And what we wind up getting is a fair number of laws that at best are kind of dead letters. They go on the books, but no one can enforce them and no one can use them. But at worst, we get things like, you know, the Consumer, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, which has been in the news so much lately. It was a law that was passed for the purpose of protecting government computers. It kind of got sloppily amended to include private computers. And, you know, this is become the tool of choice for prosecutors who don't have anything else to go after somebody for if they're a cyber bully or if they've used a system in violation of terms of service agreement. And now they can turn that into a criminal prosecution whenever they feel like. That obviously was not the intent of the law, but it was poorly drafted and it didn't take into consideration how quickly things were changing. I think those are the kinds of laws that the iAwful list is highlighting. And yeah, they've gotten unfortunately the list could get longer all the time.
Yeah, and I'm sure you would probably include the Right to Know Act on here. They're more specifically targeting laws that go to requiring more things from companies in the way of privacy policies, which California is already one of the most stringent, if not the most stringent states out there for what they require companies to do in the way of privacy disclosures, such that California sort of sets the benchmark that others have to live up to if they hope to do business in this state. They may as well hit that, and then the other states are covered too. So here it's talking about, and we've discussed this on the show, the proposal to limit mobile app privacy policies to 100 words, recognizing that people on the go are less likely to read a whole lot of legalese. And then another proposed law in California that would require more disclosure in privacy policies, presumably not in the mobile context. But we've got it. Certainly what this is telling me is there are a lot of, would you say, moral panics, Larry, on the privacy front these days?
I would.
And legislators are struggling to come to terms with what their constituents want.
Yeah.
How do you think this is all going to shake out?
Well, we have to blame one other party here. I mean, these moral panics are, it's sort of, you know, the constituents call the legislators and say, you know, I'm scared of Google Glass or something is making me very unhappy, whatever it is. But we should also blame the media here, including blaming ourselves. A lot of these things are just whipped up by both the tech media and the mainstream media. You see some of the headlines, governments, spying on you or everything, all the ways companies are tracking everything you do. And the headlines are always very sensational. Often you read the story, which of course most people don't bother to do, but when they do, you realize, oh, well, this is not actually, you know, what it sounded like. It's something much more mundane or something much more limited. I honestly don't know what's going to happen in the privacy debate. This has been something that's worried me for the last several years, and I you know, wrote a long policy analysis about this that was published in January, where I said, you know, until we actually kind of have rational discussion and terms of discussion, what we're probably going to do is just get kind of, you know, every now and then, this is what's going on in Congress for the last 2 years, is you get a whole froth of bills that circulate, lots of hearings, you know, lots of, you know, kind of sanctimonious fist shaking at companies for doing X or doing Y, or sometimes for doing both or for doing neither. Sometimes they want you to collect more information if it's something that law enforcement needed. Sometimes they want you to less information if it's something that, you know, people wanted to be deleted sooner. And nothing actually gets passed. So in some ways, that's good. I mean, it's kind of a wasted energy to go through this, but better to pass no laws than to pass bad laws. And, you know, really, so far on this kind of stuff, I've not seen any legislation that really understood the technology it was trying to regulate, had identified a genuine user harm, and had kind of crafted a remedy that could honestly be said to solve the problem without costing more than the problem itself.
Right, Kevin, it's kind of an ick factor, isn't it? People have knee-jerk responses to things that don't sound good to them, but
right,
that doesn't necessarily translate into making good law.
Right, I'd agree with that 100%. You know, you look at, you know, the outcry that came with the death of Aaron Swartz, and it was, you know, quite, you know, justly, you know, people are, you know, complaining about, you know, how the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is worded, and then, but you know, so many knee jerk reactions to his death. You know, people would have passed, you know, what potentially could have been, you know, worse legislation if it was not carefully drafted, and you know, I certainly agree that it's better to pass no law than it is to pass bad law. And I think, you know, careful heads should hopefully prevail. You know, the problem is, you know, Congress, you know, isn't always, you know, the best heads out there to debate some of these issues, but it's what we have. And I can certainly hope that, you know, that they'll, you know, take a look at this and you know, go forward. But, you know, this is a particular California bill. I mean, you know, it's one I was not particularly following that closely as a, you know, out here in Illinois. You know, we think fondly of you folks out there in California, but, you know, it doesn't affect us as much as others would. But I think...
Right, except when your companies want to do business here.
Exactly. That is certainly true. Exactly. Yeah. We have to comply. So, I mean, I was following it, but not as closely, obviously, as you folks had been. I think, you know, it's certainly delayed for consideration. I think, you know, this particular bill is something that, you know, needs more debate and, you know, more discussion of what it intends to do. And hopefully some redrafting if that is truly is what it needs.
Well, folks are certainly concerned about being tracked on the internet. They're concerned about being tracked in the real world, too, much so that there was a bit of a public outcry against Nordstrom when it came out that they had for several months been using the media access control address on people's smartphones, which is something that is broadcast when your phone is seeking for a Wi-Fi signal.
Right.
And what they would do is lock onto that and basically track people's progress through the store. You know, what would they look at? Where would they stop? Would they say they were not collecting any personal information from the phones, but simply using this as sort of a traffic flow monitoring device in the store to give them more information about how people shop. This was not popularly received, even though it does appear that Nordstrom was advising people. They had a sign on a wall, which you, I suppose, could easily just walk right by, saying that they were doing this and that you should turn off your device's Wi-Fi function or power off your device if you did not want to be tracked in this way. But they'd been using it for 8 months when this all came out in the public eye. They decided to stop doing it. They say that was just a coincidence and that they'd, you know, tested the system all that they wanted to and learned enough about doing it that way. And they were done. But certainly people weren't pleased about this. Is this an education problem, Larry, where people just need to know that this is a possible thing you can do when your phone is searching for Wi-Fi and that you should maybe turn that off, not just to save the battery, but also because it's a privacy concern?
Well, I feel, Denise, like I'm sounding like really very cranky today. and as I was running through the show last night and this morning, I thought, oh, everything I'm going to say is going to make me sound like a total crank. So I'm going to apologize for this. No, I don't think this is I think this is an education problem, not of consumers learning to avoid this. It's an education problem for Nordstrom's learning how to explain it better. Because as it was clear, as you just said, and as the article that you note and the notice itself say, is there is no privacy issue here in the sense that it is not collecting any information that is personal or personally identifiable. It is privacy information of the device. It's keeping track of, you know, where's the device and where is it moving to. But there is utterly nothing that is involved in that. And, you know, I'm sure I'm going to hear from people saying, oh, but you could use that in, you know, three other data elements, and in 5 seconds you could identify who the person is. The question I think to always ask is, well, why would a store want to do this? You know, are they evil people who are you know, trying to you know, figure out how to steal funds from your account, or they know you're at the store, so they're going to send, you know, a team of Nordstrom shoppers to your home to rob you? This is not obviously the reason. Why they want to know where people are in the store and how they move, not specific people, but people, is because they want to make the store better. They want to figure out, well, if, you know, people go from this department to this department all the time and they're four floors apart, huh, maybe we should move those two departments closer together. Or, you know, if they see that, you know, one section of the store doesn't get any traffic because it's out of the way, or, you know, because it's cut off by, you know, displays that are in the wrong place, this would help them make the store a more efficient place to shop. And presumably, as a consumer in general, you would want that if it means that, you know, they're using your movements. And when I say your, I don't mean you personally, because they have no idea who you are. They know this is a device that's moving from point A to point B. Well, why do we really care if they're collecting it? Well, the problem is, as you say, they didn't disclose it ahead of time. They didn't make it clear what they were collecting, and they didn't really underscore the fact that what they were tracking was movement of physical things rather than movement of individual named people and where they were going. So I think the lesson here again is, you know, Nordstrom's should have done a better job of explaining what they were doing ahead of time, and that would have, you know, wouldn't have completely diffused it, but it would have diffused it a lot and allowed it, you know, frankly, to make the stores work better, which would be in everybody's benefit.
Right. And the other education point is for consumers to know that, you know, just because you're not on the web doesn't mean you're not being tracked. Even if your smartphone is out of the equation, over at Consumerist, they have a good article. And all of the stuff that we're talking about today, you can check out yourself at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/211. Our discussion points for today. Over at Consumerist, they have the various other ways that stores track you. Of course, there are cameras everywhere in stores, and, you know, they don't need your phone to watch the traffic, the flow of traffic through the store, and learn the kinds of things that Larry was talking about, that, you know, they want to gather that kind of intelligence to sell you more stuff and figure out ways to sell you more stuff. So, you know, the cameras are everywhere. Personalized advertising that people both opt into and that might not be opt into. This was interesting to me. Some stores use RFID tags on merchandise so that while you're carrying something around and you haven't bought it or tried it on yet, they can somehow decide, you know, if there's a video monitor in the store, it can detect that ID and give you an ad based on what it is you're carrying. Maybe, you know, encouraging you to go ahead and bite the bullet and buy that $300 sweater you were mulling over. There's some interesting stuff in this article at Consumerist. I encourage you guys to check out. And I think we'll make moral panic our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, since we're discussing a number of those. Let's move on to Google. Larry, you already brought up the moral panics around glass. At I.O. this week, Google finally came out and hit that issue head on and addressed some of the privacy concerns. We have Steve Lee, Glass's product director, saying the device was actually built to alleviate these concerns, even the non-consumer version that you're seeing around in photographs and discussed on the web these days, that it was designed to address the privacy concerns. Do you think that, I think I know the answer to this question, Larry, that the privacy concerns expressed about Google Glass are overblown?
I wasn't going to use the word overblown. I would certainly use the word premature. They're still designing the product. We don't know exactly all the things it's going to be useful for and what it's actually going to do and what it's going to look like and what privacy features will or won't be in the actual commercial version. So there was I don't know if you saw there was a letter from seven members of a bipartisan congressional working group on privacy to Larry Page. And sort of my synopsis of the letter is, we don't know what Google Glass is. We don't know what it does, but we don't like it. please change the design so that we do like it. I really sympathize. I sympathize with all companies who are trying to do new and innovative things because they continue to hit this kind of emotional response of, well, it's new and it makes me uncomfortable. That's perfectly understandable. That's human nature. But then to then take the next step and say, and so just don't do it. Don't do it until I get comfortable with it or just make it so I'm not uncomfortable, but I can't tell you specifically what I'm uncomfortable with. I think, in one way, I just finished an article on Google Glass and the privacy implications that'll be on Harvard Business Review's blog sometime next week. And I said, on the one hand, it's very odd that there's this moral panic about it because it's really, there's very little difference between Google Glass in some ways and a smartphone. The capabilities are the same. You can surreptitiously take photographs. You can surreptitiously take video using your smartphone. And you can presumably do the same thing with Google Glass. I think what they said at I.O. was that, in fact, it's going to be harder to do it surreptitiously with the headset on because you've got to, stare specifically at the thing in a way you wouldn't. You could sort of hold your camera and kind of hide where you're pointing, but in fact with your face, as I think the example was, if you're in a bathroom and that's one of the places people are worried about Google Glass, you're in a public bathroom and someone is staring at you, whether they're wearing a headset or not, it's probably a good indication that you should leave or take action or alert the authorities. So I'm not going to say that these concerns are overblown because I think it's too early to say whether or not they're overblown.
Right.
Right. One of the things that's pointed out in the article at The Verge, though, is that you actually, you at least have to be facing that direction, but you can be glancing away and Glass can be recording or taking a picture. They are being careful that the display has to be active when Glass is active. So presumably you'll be able to see that the thing is on. I'm not sure how that works from the front. I think maybe from the side you could determine that the display was on, that the person was viewing. But I don't know if there's a flashing light on the front of this thing. As far as I can tell, there is not at this point.
Not in the current
version. Not at this point.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
The Glass team is saying our design is to ensure that at least the display is active when Glass is active, and so apps won't be permitted to turn that off. Kevin, do you think that's enough?
Well, I think, that's, a good step, in the right direction. I think, let's see what the final version is. I was going to point out that, here in Chicago, we're still debating, the benefits of having cell phones with cameras. Our local courts have come up with a little more restrictive policy on people bringing in cameras, cell phones with cameras, into the courtroom that's, taken in effect in the last few months. We're still debating, smartphones, much less, glass. So, it's, you know, by all means, it's an issue, you know, regardless of the means of the technology, you know, whether it's something mounted on your face or whether it's something you carry in your hand, you know, the fact that it can record, you know, that there should be, you know, considerations for, you know, letting people know that they're being recorded and all that.
It'll be fun to see what the Germans make of Google Glass when they're finally available there. Over in Germany this week, a German court ruled that the autocomplete feature in Google violates some German privacy laws. This is the feature that when you begin typing in a search, you get a little list of searches that Google thinks you might be interested in making. So if you type in someone's name, then there might be some words afterwards that have been associated with that person's name in other searches. Problematic in Germany is that the wife of the former German president, Christian Wolf, had search terms come up with her name that were things like escort and prostitute. She didn't like that at all. And then another gentleman sued, and his name was being associated with Scientology and also with swindle by autocomplete. He didn't much care for that. And he actually was successful in his case. But it's interesting that the German court is not putting upon Google a proactive kind of obligation here. They're not supposed to be able to divine what search terms are going to pop up in connection with people's names. But if they are somehow privacy implicating, they can be addressed after the fact and people can sue over that. So, you know, once again, I don't know how Glass is going to fare in this kind of atmosphere. Larry, what did you think about this case?
Yeah, so it's sort of essentially, as you just described it, it's kind of what the court is asking for here is kind of a notice and takedown regime, where
right.
Where if somebody complains, and I'm not sure you know what the criteria are that they are allowed to complain. Again, you know, the funny thing about this is it looks as though, and then this is, I think, part of the problem with technology is it's getting so good that it's starting, you know, the sort of artificial intelligence aspect of it, it's starting to look like there's people back there doing stuff when, in fact, there's no people at all. So the way autocomplete works is, you know, everybody knows if they think about it for a second, is all Google is doing is kind of keeping track of what things get searched for together. So as you start typing a name, it says, all right, well, when people type that name, you know, what's the most frequent thing that they type next? And then the second and third and the fourth and the fifth thing they most frequently type next. So all it's not, there's no editorial decision here. There's no subjective judgment on the part of, you know, somebody sitting around at Google saying, oh, if you're looking for that person, you know, you should know that they're an X or a Y, or that they're affiliated with this thing or this terrible thing in their past, which may or may not be true. They're just saying this is what everybody else has wanted to find out about that person. And so that's a good thing, right? It's helpful if it's saving you time and when you're searching, if that in fact is, you know, one of the things you were looking for and it's in the list and you don't have to type it, great. It makes it that much more efficient. But of course it looks like, I mean, I think that's the concern that the Germans have, is it looks like it's some kind of an editorial comment. It looks like it's, you know, saying, you know, this is a headline or this is actual news or this is a fact about this person, is that when this word comes up, then you immediately come, you know, associate it with that word. Well, I think it would be much harder in this country from a legal standpoint to try and control that kind of behavior, because, you know, in some ways, if it was editorializing, it would be protected by the First Amendment. It would be subject to, obviously, to defamation law if, in fact, you know, you were saying that X was a prostitute or Y was a fraud or somebody was, you know, committing some crime that they, in fact, weren't committing. You know, then you could, you know, then you'd have a private action. But if you're, you know, in terms of what people can editorialize about, we have in this country a much sort of, you know, freer marketplace of ideas than they do in Europe, which potentially turns these things into questions about privacy and saying, well, you know, even if X is a convicted felon, or even if X, you know, really did get caught canoodling with Y, you still, you know, can't can't talk about that in public because they have a right to control truthful information in a way that in this country, you know, truthful information is sort of off limits in terms of government control. So I think it causes problems, and I think it's, you know, quite honestly, it's a big part of the reason why, you know, so much of the information revolution and the new products and innovations that come out of it happen in this country and get exported to the rest of the world, because, you know, we're much more free about the use of information, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, Europe has no internet companies to compete.
Well, your article about Best Buy last year must have been really popular, because that's the autocomplete, the first autocomplete result for you, Larry, is Larry Downs Best Buy.
Yeah, 3.5 million page views on that article so far.
That qualifies. Kevin, I'm with Larry. I can't see anything like this ever flying here. Could you?
No, I really can't. There is a... you know, particular case I know recently in the last few months where somebody did sue over the autocomplete and lost. I should also probably point out that I've got a special guest here in the office. I don't know if the camera can show, but
yes,
I've got
absolutely.
A guest here reading Larry's book.
Reading some of the classics.
I don't know if you can hear him.
Yes. Hi, Evan. Good to see you. How'd your talk go?
She asked how your talk went.
It went great.
Good.
It went great.
Good.
So anyways, Larry is reading my copy of the killer app, which I took off my bookshelf when I realized that Larry was going to be on the show, and previously had signed by Chunka Mui. So too bad you're not here in person, Larry. I'd get you to sign the other part of the front cover.
Well, if you send it to me, I'll happily sign it and send it back.
Sounds good.
That's funny.
All right. Well, I'm glad we could have Evan's cameo there.
Right.
Believe it or not, we've made it through all the privacy stories. This would probably be a good time to take a break and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile by Citrix. You know, it's not only what we do at work these days, but how we do it that makes the difference. Our flow of information needs to be ongoing, collaborative, and time efficient, whether we're working at the office or on the go. And ShareFile helps you do all of that easily and securely. Now, we've been talking about a lot of privacy stories today on This Week in Law. ShareFile fits right in with that environment because it's going to integrate into your daily routine, no matter where you are, from any mobile device, to help you keep your business communications both private and effective. What it does is it sends files of almost any size as secure links. So you no longer have to worry about bounce backs. You no longer have to worry, is this going to go through or not? Is it going to be received? Not only are you sure that the link is going to work, but you also can get confirmation from ShareFile that, yes, this file was accessed, by whom, what they did with it. So you know, as a business person, exactly what's going on with your workflow, which is great. Notifications are sent to you when things are opened. You can track the progress of what's going on with the item you've shared. You can password protect for ultimate control. And this is a really critical thing for any business, obviously. When you're sharing files, you can't have uncertainty about whether it's gotten there. You can't have uncertainty about whether it's going to be secure and confidential. You also, in the legal realm, oftentimes are in an adversarial or advocacy kind of situation where you really might have to show someone, yes, so-and-so got this notice or received this file, and I can show you that right here. Here's the receipt. So ShareFile is very, very helpful with that. Plus, you can set up shared folders for easy collaboration with clients and coworkers. So go ahead and give it a try. It's going to change the way that you work. To help you get started, I have a special 30-day free trial offer with no obligation. You'll see the difference right away. So to get the special offer, go to ShareFile.com today, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com. Type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. So we're here with Larry Downs, man about the internet, writer and thinker extraordinaire, and the cyber lawyer, Kevin Thompson, and talking about all kinds of informational and interesting stuff. Let's move on to some copyright considerations. So, hey, speaking of glass, I guess it was just a matter of time before someone decided, with all the pictures of people and pictures being taken by people wearing glass out there these days, to make their own and do it on a 3D printer. Someone in China, an entrepreneur named Sunny Gao, did this. And what's so funny to me is Sunny seems pretty serious that he'll be able to make, you know, a functional version of glass this way eventually. Right now it's just, you know, something made out of 3D printed plastic that looks like he's wearing glass. He says it's in the pre-alpha stage. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. So it doesn't work the way you would want it to. Other components. Yes, such as the processor, sensors, and microcams are still in preparation. So basically everything that makes it work, this is coming to us via Mashable. Very funny. But Larry, beyond the humor of just, you know, people wanting to get their hands on glass by any means possible, what do you think about the long-term ramifications of being able to duplicate products like this?
Well, it's great. So this is wonderful. And actually, I don't think it's all that funny, because in the sense of it's not going to be that hard. If you think about it, I don't obviously know the tech specs on Google Glass, but I'm guessing that most of the components are off-the-shelf, you know, accelerometers and cameras and all the other things that go into smartphones and go increasingly into other products, drones and everything else. I just got a new, I would show it to you if I was live on the camera, but I just got a new Fitbit Flex, which is tracking my, you know, steps and sleep patterns. It's basically just using off-the-shelf components that also go into smartphones. And because there are these billions and billions of smartphones being made, the price and the sort of standardization of many of these components has gotten to the point where you can, you know, very cheaply embed them into pretty much anything. So really all the, you know, and of course the glasses part of glasses isn't very interesting. All you really got left is the software. And of course in Google's case, much of their software is open source or, you know, openly licensed software. So it's not really out of the question that somebody with a 3D printer and the same off-the-shelf component parts and access to the same software could in fact duplicate it. It's an interesting problem. Obviously, the bigger issue with 3D printing is it's yet another example of, you know, technology getting way ahead of the law, and particularly copyright law. Right. So we understand that the main reason copyright law has worked for the last 200 years or so is that not because it's so easy to enforce it when somebody infringes a copyright, but because it's so expensive and so visible when you do. So, you know, 100 years ago, if you wanted to take a copyrighted book and sell copies without authority, without license, you needed printing presses, you needed distribution mechanisms, you needed to sell it in public where other people could see you do it. It was relatively, you know, sort of self-enforcing in that sense. Well, now that everything, of course, is in a digital form, both in terms of its creation and its distribution, those kind of barriers to entry are gone. And what we find is that, you know, copyright law really doesn't work very well in an age where sort of marginal cost comes down to next to nothing. So obviously the 3D printers are going to bring out all kinds of interesting new problems, not just of copyright, but of patent and trademark as well. And I suspect what we'll find is that, you know, where the interesting legal developments will happen will be more in terms of trademark and trade dress, and somewhat in design patent, which doesn't get used much, but it probably will get used more as a way of kind of protecting, you know, proprietary designs from being turned into 3D printed knockoffs.
Kevin, do you think we're moving toward, with this low cost and easy production capability that 3D printing represents, toward some sort of regime where there will be mandatory licensing of people's creations? And if you can demonstrate that something that you've designed has been copied verbatim, then you're entitled to royalties. How do you think we'll manage this?
That's an interesting idea. That sounds very patent-like in its application. You know, if you prove something is done that way. I think that there's a certain potential for something like that. I think it certainly would take a little more rational thought before deciding whether that's actually a good idea, you know. But I think it's going to make it so much you know, simpler for copying, as you know, has been pointed out. You know, you're looking at you know, an age in which you know, file sharing is such an easy way, you know, for people to distribute, you know, electronic copies of electronic works. You know, the 3D printing is bringing the same resolution, you know, revolution to printed and sorry, to physical goods. And I think it's just going to make it so much easier for people to, you know, to do this. Before, you would need you know, your own fab shop, and now you know, you can get, you know, stuff done in a, with a the printer. And so, you know, a licensing regime like that is certainly, you know, possible. I think, you know, we certainly have, you know, mandatory licensing schemes in other areas of copyright, such as music, you know, where there's a, you know, a mandatory license, you know, for certain types of audio works that, you know, you use it and, you know, you pay the royalty. And I think, you know, that's certainly, you know, one approach that could work for certain things. I think it will take some careful thought, but, you know, that's certainly an interesting idea.
Well, the Supreme Court this week in a patent case, and let's go ahead and shift into the patent realm for a minute. Kaboom. The Supreme Court dropped the bomb in a case that involved something that's not cheaply and easily replicated, but self-replicated, the lovely soybean. This has been a long time in coming. This case has been in the courts for a while. It's a case between a farmer and Monsanto over seed patents. And it was not a tough call for the Supreme Court at all. It was a 9-0 decision in Monsanto's favor. And let me just lay out the facts of this a little bit for you in case you haven't looked at them so you understand what was being argued. There was a farmer here who wanted to plant crops of soybeans and wanted to specifically plant and raise Monsanto's Roundup Ready herbicide-resistant soybeans, which means, I suppose, that you can spray these things and control weeds all you like, and it's not going to affect the soybeans. They're going to grow just fine. And this particular kind of soybean was patented by Monsanto. And when they sell this bean to farmers, they do so with a restriction that you can plant one crop of these things, but you then cannot use the beans that your soybeans have produced to plant more of them. You have to go back to Monsanto and buy the Roundup Ready herbicide resistant bean again for your next crop. Well, the farmer in this case, Mr. Bowman, decided he was going to try a workaround on this. And so he did one crop of the legitimately purchased beans that, you know, adequately authorized by Monsanto to grow them. And then instead of using the seeds from those beans, he went to a grain elevator, knowing that these beans are really prevalent and that if you just go and buy a bunch of soybeans and then you spray them with herbicide, the ones that are going to survive are the Monsanto beans. So he bought them from this grain elevator, planted them, winnowed out the ones that were going to be the Roundup Ready herbicide resistant beans, and planted those, and then planted the seeds of those, and on and on, and was sued by Monsanto and awarded at trial. Monsanto was awarded $30,000 against this guy for doing this workaround. The argument that they made all the way up to the Supreme Court, the farmer did, was that it's not me. It's the beans. The beans are doing the replicating. And I bought these beans legitimately with no restrictions on them from the grain elevator. So the patents here have been exhausted and I'm authorized to do what I'm doing. The Supreme Court had no problem knocking that down and saying, you know what, that defeats the entire patent system. It defeats Monsanto's ability to have a market in this product that it has worked hard to genetically engineer. And so, sorry, farmer, you're out of luck. So I kind of see this as a parallel to what we were discussing in the 3D printing context, that the courts, when presented with this kind of, it's going to make the whole patent regime obsolete situation, are going to step in and say, we're not going to let that happen. Larry, do you see where I'm going with this?
I do. It's a wonderful case. I mean, not for the farmer, obviously, but it does have such a delicious fact pattern to it. And as you say, it was a 9-0 decision written by Justice Kagan. And in some ways, it makes a certain amount of sense, and you have to kind of ask certain basic questions. Like, well, obviously, what wasn't at issue here was not whether or not one should be able to get a patent on a bean. So they obviously, Monsanto had done some genetic engineering of the soybean to get it to have these particular properties. That's what they had a patent on, and whether or not that patent was valid or whether or not they should have a patent on a genetically engineered product was not at issue here. That's, you know, long decided. That's at least under current patent law, that's okay. And also, what wasn't really at issue here was whether or not, let's say what was at issue here is, in a sense, what did Monsanto have a patent for? Well, they had a patent for a machine, in this case a bean, that makes more of itself. One of the features of this bean is that it self-replicates. Well, if you think back to the sort of early history of patent, the idea of a machine that makes more of itself automatically, and that's part of the process you're patenting, would have seemed, you know, science fiction or wild or crazy, but that's the world we live in now. We can make machines, in this case biological machines, that can make more of themselves. And that was a feature. That's what's covered, you know, partly what's covered by the patent. And the court said, you know, whether or not we think that's efficient, good use of resources, well, maybe it's important for Monsanto to limit the number of generations that you use it for, because essentially the cost of you buying more of the beans every season is how we fund our billions of dollars of research and development. Maybe that's right. Maybe that's wrong. In some ways, it doesn't really matter, because the patent system has decided that's a legitimate kind of invention for patentability. And the real question here isn't, you know, the farmer lost it because it was self-replicating, and that was part of the protection, so too bad. But I think probably the bigger question, which wasn't really a part of the case, is it time to revisit patent law and ask the more fundamental question of, well, what sort of inventions do we want to give that protection to, and is this, in fact, one of them? As we've talked about many times, and you've talked about many times without me, the patent system is way behind the times in terms of how technology has put pressure on invention and innovation, and shortened the lifespan of useful innovations, perhaps to their point where they're shorter than the patent that's been granted, and therefore maybe we should change the term of patent, or we should give different terms for different kinds of inventions. That wasn't an issue in this particular case, but the fact pattern does kind of remind us that the patent system is really living in the 19th century and not the 21st.
It was really important for Justice Kagan in this case that the farmer stepped in, bought the beans, planted them, knew they would grow when he did that. Presumably, if you're buying beans in a grain elevator, I guess, they're not for planting. I'm not familiar enough with the world of agriculture to speak definitively on that. But my assumption as I read through this stuff is that you might buy them for feed or for consumption. Yes, but not for planting. So she makes this point that in another case, the article's self-replication might occur outside the purchaser's control, and that might lead to a different result. What do you think of that, Kevin?
Yeah, I thought that was, this is certainly possible. I think, that there is, a lot of application here. In the future, I think, this sort of rule, that they're coming up with here, for these particular beans could be, problematic with some other device or some other, engineered product. I think, as more of these, bioengineered foods and things like that get out there, I think, this, is only going to come up in more fact scenarios. And I think people are going to be applying this case in, you know, ways, you know, that will apply to their case. And I think, you know, there will be some follow-up case in the future, I think, that'll, you know, further test this. You know, I can speak, you know, from my past experience growing up in Wisconsin, that, you know, you buy something at the grain elevator, it's, you know, generally for feed. You know, so, you know, I think, you know, that was, you know, part of it there. You know, the person, you know, got it through a way that, you know, wasn't the normal distribution method, you know, for picking up, you know, seeds for planting. So,
it kind of kills me, though. I mean, there's no restriction when you go to the grain elevator. You can do whatever you want with what you've bought there, right? There's nothing, terms of service that come with your grain,
right?
At that point,
yeah.
So this guy was just kind of clever, but got shot down big time, especially because over time his damages have mounted with interest applied.
I was thinking also that, you know, soybeans is not the only thing that we've talked about today that could be self-replicating. Circles back to 3D printers. I think, you know, a decent number of them can be self-replicating as well.
Right.
So, you know, I think, you know, there's be more application of this particular principle in the future.
So getting back to your machines that make themselves, Larry, what's going to happen in this other case that Justice Kagan has called out here?
Sorry, which other case was that?
The case where an article self-replication might occur outside the purchaser's control.
That's a good one. Yeah, it comes up a lot, actually. In fact, that has come up a lot. I know a couple of patent cases where when you're working with molecules, so this happens a lot in drug development. You're trying to invent a drug, and you know you're doing it at the molecular level. And even though you've maintained a clean room for all the right reasons, both legal and you know for purposes of design, it's entirely possible for a patented molecule to get into the mix. And you think you've invented a new one, when in fact it just snuck in. You know, it came in, you know, through the air filtration system or something else. And this came up, I think, in a antidepressant drug patent case a couple of years ago, where Judge Posner was sitting by designation as a trial judge and spent, you know, many months going sort of through all the stuff that could have led to it. Well, it's not clear what would happen. Again, if it happens outside your control, the thing about patent law, again, to remember is it's not like copyright law in the sense that you don't need to have intended to do anything. If you, in a sort of completely clean environment without any knowledge of the other invention, if you miraculously invent the exact same thing yourself without looking at the other design, without knowledge of the other design, it doesn't matter. There's no sort of morality in patent law. If you reinvent the same thing, if somebody already has a patent on it, doesn't matter how you came up with it, you're still infringing on their patent if you make a identical copy. So I think that would probably weigh heavily in sort of the, you know, unintended replication case. It's like, well, if it made more of itself, and therefore it's still the patented thing, and there's more of them, that's a copy, and that copy infringes a patent. Whether you had any sort of moral guilt or not doesn't really figure in the patent equation.
All right, well, let's go ahead and make soybeans our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're interested in listening to the show for continuing legal education or other professional credit, head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Go to the Twill page there, and you'll find lots more information. But we put these words in the show in case you need to demonstrate that you really did listen. We just sort of throw them in at random, and you can say, yep, I know the two passphrases, and I can show I've listened to the show. So let's move on, Larry. I love this line from the article about the all IP future and getting rid of switched phone networks. The one from January that you wrote at the CES Broadband Unlimited conference, and you were quoting Daniel Berninger, pioneer in voiceover IP communications, now president of the nonprofit Voice Communications Exchange Committee. He says that if Benjamin Braddock were hanging out in his swimming pool today, the advice that he would be given was not plastics, but all IP telco.
Yeah.
But the FCC is not making that easy, is it?
Well, it's not, and of course, it's not surprising. And the FCC has a lot of reasons, both kind of institutional and frankly political, for wanting to hold on to the regulation of switched network of the PSTN system of telephony as long as they can, because that's essentially their expertise, and frankly, that's where their legal authority is largely centered. But of course, the breakdown or the reality between what's happening, you know, at the FCC as they're starting and stalling to talk about the eventual retirement of the old switch network in favor of an all IP network, and the reality on the ground where, you know, more and more Americans are ditching their landlines at a faster pace all the time for either cable or fiber or for over the top VoIP alternatives for their sort of main or wireless, of course, for their main telephony. It's almost like the FCC is operating in a different world than the rest of us. The problem here is, you know, in some ways, well, who cares? Because eventually, you know, we're going to be down to just a very small percentage, I would say a handful of people, very very small percentage of Americans who will still be relying on the old switch network, and that may be because they're in remote areas where there is no alternative yet. They can't get any other kind of voice service. There may just be people who are, you know, kind of from inertia, or they're older, or they're whatever reason, they don't have a wireless connection, or they don't have a cable, or they don't use the internet. But the problem is that if we just kind of let this process happen on its own, it's remarkably expensive now. In some sense, the remaining landline phone companies are maintaining two different networks, and the IP network, and then they're putting billions into changing their equipment over as fast as they can from the switch network to the IP network, but they're still having to maintain in many parts of the country the old copper, the old switches, the old analog switches, the old equipment, the old software, and so on. And as fewer and fewer people are actually using that system, as they cut the cord, the sort of maintenance cost per person is going up to some astronomical amount of money, and eventually it's going to be, you know, one person who's still using it, and the FCC requires you can't shut it off without permission of the FCC. Even if there are alternatives, you still need permission, and also from state regulators. So at some point, it's going to be, you know, one person out in, you know, Ted Kaczynski out in his shack in Montana still has a landline, and the cost of maintenance, you know, for him is, you know, $100 billion a year to keep the system up.
Right. I mean, is there something that the telcos can do to, you know, I mean, obviously it's going to be less expensive for them to go ahead and provide these last holdouts with whatever equipment they need, or, you know, is there anything they're going to be able to do to ease the transition?
Sure. I mean, you know, look, no one is suggesting, the telcos aren't suggesting, and the FCC is certainly not suggesting that they would be allowed to ever shut off the system until everybody who, you know, currently has a voice line or a DSL line has some alternative. And that's why, as I say, they're spending, you know, billions, and they've recently kind of upped their investment to get the equipment switched over as fast as they can. Well, obviously, you know, it's easier to do in urban areas than it is in rural areas. And I think part of the hang up is that because of the vastness of the United States and the way in which the population is, you know, some parts of the population are so remote, that for some number of people in remote mountain areas or rural areas, what the phone companies would like to offer them is a competitively priced wireless alternative, and say, look, we can't afford to lay fiber, or it's just not, you know, it's just not cost effective to lay fiber to your general area with a copper loop to attach to it. What we want to do is switch you off of a landline to a mobile line, and frankly, frankly, the mobile service will be better. It will include, you know, broadband internet, which you may not even have access to today. The FCC will ensure that from a pricing standpoint, that's not a, you know, a bait and switch that makes them go from a cheap service to an expensive service. That would be the preference, but they cannot do that without permission of state and federal regulators. And state and federal regulators, they're not saying no. They're just saying, oh, well, let's keep studying and studying and studying, and maybe we'll have a trial about this and test it out, and maybe we won't. As I say, meanwhile, the transition is happening in this very disorganized way.
Do you think with the new FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, coming in, there's going to be any progress?
Well, that's, you're being very optimistic about Wheeler's confirmation process, even when it's going to start. I think the last thing I saw was that Congress was saying it's not going to happen before the summer recess. I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, Mr. Wheeler is sensibly not giving interviews about what his intentions are once he becomes a chairman. And obviously, he only gets one vote. He needs the other chair, you know, at least two other commissioners to go along with any kind of major policy change. In Congress, of course, can also weigh in. They did this for the digital television transition, which I think is the closest analogy and, frankly, the place where we could learn the most lessons about what works and doesn't work in a major technological transformation. So it may not just be the FCC. It may be Congress and, again, the state CPUCs as well involved. But, I don't think certainly Chairman Jenikowski, who left this week, did not exercise or display a whole lot of leadership on this issue. He may have just been exhausted by the time it, you know, it kind of bubbled up. But if you go back to the 2010 National Broadband Plan, which, you know, the FCC produced, it was a brilliant document. It was very clear that that the agency needed to get proactive about this, set a timetable, set a deadline for switchover, you know, set procedures in place to make sure no one would be left behind and that, you know, all the other things that have to happen would happen. The agency just has not done anything about it in the 3 years since then.
All right. Well, topically enough, Julius Jenikowski has his own Twitter account as of 2 hours ago. You can follow him over at J Jenikowski on Twitter. Kevin, are you less morally panicked about the FCC dragging its feet here? Do you think this will all shake itself out?
Well, I think we'll see how this all works out. I agree with Larry. I think looking to how the digital transition for television worked, I think is certainly going to be instructional. That certainly was the first thing that came to my mind, you know, when I heard about this, you know, particular, you know, provision there. So, you know, that worked, you know, for the most part, all right. You know, some hiccups here and there. You know, but I think it's going to take a lot more thought, you know, to get into it, you know, before they start doing this for, you know, this other service for telephone. So, you know, I think, you know, we'll see how it all shakes out in the end. I think it's going to take a lot of careful thought, and we'll see, you know, whether or not Mr. Wheeler, you know, makes it on the panel sufficiently to, you know, to be, you know, have his voice heard on this. But regardless, you know, we'll see.
All right. Well, speaking of people panicking, the AP was panicking this week when it was notified by the Justice Department that its reporters' phone calls had been monitored and surveilled in connection with a leak related to a terrorist event in Yemen, I believe. So how this works, I guess, is the Justice Department has the ability to clandestinely get these records from a news agency for a limited amount of time. But then they have to let the news agency know, hey, we're looking at your reporter's phone records. So that's how this all came out. The AP was outraged. A series of letters, communications went back and forth over whether the subpoenas were sufficiently limited in time and scope. Meanwhile, the AP is still upset and the Justice Department is still saying, you know, we needed this information to conduct our investigation. What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, so this is is one of those stories where, certainly at this point, we can say really very little because we don't have a lot of the facts. We don't have a great deal of information, and it may be that we never get enough of it to talk about because a lot of it is classified. As you say, apparently there was a leak in the Department of Justice to the AP, and that leak resulted in the compromising of a confidential informant who apparently was embedded or about to be embedded in Al Qaeda. So, needless to say, that when that leak happened and when it was reported and the informant had to be pulled out of the field, the Department of Justice understandably was very concerned about the leak and wanted to figure out how it had happened and what to do about it. I think what's important at this point, though, to say is, most of the news reports get this right, but it's not so clear from just reading the headlines, is this is not a case of wiretapping the calls. That is to say, the content of the AP reporters' calls was not at issue here. What they were subpoenaing was the actual records that just say this number called this number for this duration of time. And I think the concern, and I think that's probably under the Patriot Act, it doesn't require a warrant. It doesn't go under Fourth Amendment scrutiny because it's not talking about any of the actual underlying content of the calls. I think the concern has been with the breadth of the subpoena, how many phone numbers, the records were being asked for, and for what long period of time they were being asked for. But I know that the ACLU came out immediately and said, well, this is, clearly a legal violation. I don't feel so confident about that, partly, as I say, because we don't have much of the facts yet, but I think also because, as I say, we're not talking about a Fourth Amendment case here. We're talking about kind of the more administrative limits of subpoena power under the Patriot Act and sort of, other related criminal statutes that do allow the government to request records, not content, but records from phone providers and about the calls. And whatever it turns out to be, as I say, I don't feel confident to say, oh, yes, this was clearly a abuse of power or not. But whatever the ultimate result will be, it won't be about the actual underlying content. It will be about the breadth of the subpoenas.
Right. I guess the AP is taking issue with the fact that while five or six people worked on the story, the subpoenas were looking at calls made by far more of its staff.
Yeah.
Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the use of the subpoena power is something that, we've talked about a lot on prior shows, everything ranging from, Google's response to subpoenas to, other email providers, things like that. So I think, the subpoenas are a useful, tool, but I think once the facts get out a little bit more, if it ever gets out, we might be able to, look at the propriety of that, whether in this particular case, these were properly tailored subpoenas, sufficient for them to track down this leak that they think they had of, this classified information, for this, terrorism case. And they felt the need to go this route because, they thought, with, some justification based on their preliminary research, that, somebody in this particular, range of AP reporters, somebody in that pool, potentially could have been the leak. And, I think they only went this way, because they had to, but, we'll see whether the facts actually pan out that way. That's certainly how the government is currently trying to spin it. We'll see whether that, truly is the case. We may never see, but I think, people looking into it will try to determine that.
All right. Well, we have a couple of tips and resources for you this week. Our first tip is along the lines of what you can and cannot say about people in the context of Yelp or other online opinion expressing services. Court case came out this week, decided that a doctor who had sued because a patient, or actually the son of a patient, took issue with his bedside manner, just didn't think that, the doctor had responded in a way that was appropriate. At one point wrote that one of the nurses called the doctor a tool, the doctor sued for defamation, and the court determined, no, I'm sorry, you can call someone a tool, and that's a statement of opinion, even if it's, you know, the opinion of the person who posted and not the nurse. So go ahead and call your doctor a tool. You're not going to probably face defamation liability for that because it's an opinion. Now, the other tip that I had flowed from a story on BuzzFeed called The Most Epic Brand Meltdown on Facebook Ever. And the tip would be, if you're a restaurant and something called Kitchen Nightmares comes to you and decides they're going to do a show about your restaurant, the idea, first and foremost, would be, I would think, to run for the hills. But if you opt in and go on this show and you find that the host, Gordon Ramsay, thinks that your restaurant is not up to snuff, you know, you can't take it to Facebook and fight it out there. And if you do, you can't threaten to sue all the people that hate you. Because when you read through this post, these restaurant owners now are saying, though, that their Facebook and Yelp accounts where they were threatening to sue and call the police on all the people that were criticizing their restaurant, that those were not them, that their accounts were hacked. So now who knows whether they said these things or not. But whoever was posting on their behalf on their Facebook, Yelp, and Twitter accounts was threatening a whole lot of legal action that really did not lie in these people's favor. So just being silly or stupid does not give you a right to sue the people who come after you online. Meanwhile, we've got a couple of great resources for you. One is from Larry. His SOPA and PIPA history book, to which he contributed, has been published. It's called Hacking Politics. It's a name your own price ebook from Demand Progress. Can you tell us a little bit about this, Larry?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, this book's been, well, obviously a year in the making, when a lot of it was captured at the time of the big fight over SOPA and PIPA, which was a year and a half ago now in December, January 2011, 2012. And the folks at Demand Progress kind of collected a lot of essays, contemporary essays, and then have then, over the last years, asked more people to write on reflection about what happened, how did the sort of successful battle against SOPA and PIPA, how did that really not only change copyright law or the course of copyright law, but how has it actually changed the relationship between internet users and the government in terms of how legislation about technology and about the internet takes place? So it's about 300 pages or so of essays, most of them relatively short, by an amazing range of people: Congressman Lofgren, Professor Lessig, some of the folks from Demand Progress, Aaron Swartz, in fact, is obviously represented as well, the people at Reddit and Wikipedia who contributed to the blackout, telling their own story about what happened, and then in retrospect, what did they think it means. So it's a really nice collection. One of the nice things they did was they put a 40 or so page too long didn't read synopsis at the beginning of the book, which just kind of pulls quotes from all the essays. So if you don't want to read the whole book, you can kind of just read the cliff notes right there in the in the book.
Love that. Mm-hmm. Well, I downloaded it. I'm looking forward to reading. Thanks, Larry, for letting us know that's available. Also available on there, or not on there, but out there on the interwebs, is a show on YouTube that is done by our technical director, Shannon Morse, and by Darren Kitchen over on TechFeed. And it is called Threatwire. And it is a short, newsy synopsis of interesting things related to privacy and security. And if you like our show, I think you'd really like Shannon's show too. So I wanted to give it a plug. I just discovered it myself. Shannon and Darren, you're doing a great job. And thanks for getting information out there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the bumper right there.
You're welcome. How long have you been doing the show?
I've been doing it for about 28 weeks now. We just started back in early or late 2012.
And they're all like about 7-8 minutes long?
Yeah, that's correct. They're all about, we've jumped it down to about 6 minutes now, and each one's about internet security, privacy, and whatever's threatening our freedom and privacy, especially in the American states.
Cool. Well, I'm very glad you guys are doing that. We'll continue to pay attention to ThreatWire as well. So thanks, guys, so much for joining us today. Larry, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure is mine. I hope next time I'm actually visible as well as audible.
Yes, we're going to have to chase the demons out of your computer equipment for next time. But it's great to chat with you in whatever form. Can you tell us if there's anything that you're up to these days that folks should be paying attention to? We know that you've got the article in Harvard Business Review that you mentioned.
Yeah, I have the Harvard Business Review piece on the blog next week on Google Glass and privacy concerns. And then I've launched, so I'm working on a book. Last time I was on the show, I mentioned that I published a long article co-authored with a colleague on in Harvard Business Review in the magazine about disruptive innovation. We are now furiously working on the book manuscript for that, and the book should be out actually by the end of the year. I'm not quite sure how that's going to happen, but somehow magically it will. But we've launched a new page on Forbes.com called Big Bang Disruption, where we're kind of giving examples from different industries of how these new disruptive technologies are changing the rules of the landscape very dramatically. And we'd love to have people read the Forbes post and join the Facebook page and the Twitter feed and help us to, in some ways, research the book because we're in a big hurry.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to that, and we're glad you spared time for us today. We won't tell.
Please,
your publisher.
Thank you.
Yeah, no. Thanks a lot, Larry. We hope to have you on again soon. And Kevin Thompson, tell us how things are going in your world and at Davis McGrath.
Things are going very well. Thank you very much. I don't have too much to plug. Our firm's webinar series on different copyright and trademark issues is going along. Did one, I guess it was earlier this month on, the upcoming changes to the trademark clearinghouse, that's coming online and, how mm-hmm. people might want to use that, for the new top level domains that are, coming online eventually, hopefully. And so we'll see how that goes. So I did one on that and, haven't posted too much to the blog itself lately, but, certain, articles as I find of interest, I certainly put out on Twitter, which is cyber law, and certainly urge people to follow me there.
Great. And I'm sure that they will, as I have done for a very long time. You always put great stuff up on Twitter. We try to do that too. I'm D Howell on Twitter. Evan is Internet Cases there. So if you want to see what's going on with us, do check there. You can send us pings there for stuff that you want to see on the show. You can always get in touch with us by email too. I'm Denise at twit.tv. He is Evan at twit.tv. And you can find us on Google Plus and on Facebook as well, where we try and post up what's going on with us during the week before the show, what stories we're considering, and hope to get your thoughts on what you'd like to have us talk about here on This Week in Law. We do the show each Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. You can join us live at twit.tv, or you can catch us after the fact and on demand. Our whole archive is available at twit.tv/twill and on iTunes and YouTube as well. So however is easiest for you, we're just glad that you join us. We love doing this every week, and we hope that you enjoy getting informed about these important issues related to tech and policy. We'll see you next time on This Week in Law.